Morning, everybody. Good to be with you, hacking and coughing as we all are. Congregation that hacks together stays together, right? Or something like that. Let's turn in our New Testaments to Philippians chapter 1. We're going to continue to work our way through the book of Philippians, or at least large sections of it, as we think about what this idea means that he is unpacking throughout this short letter about being colonists. If you remember from the first lesson, the city of Philippi itself started as a Roman colony. The Romans lived there. Everybody spoke Latin. Everybody dressed like Romans, thought like Romans, and they practiced their life as Romans. They worshiped the Roman gods there, even though they were in Macedonia. And so it's really interesting to me that Paul kind of adopts that idea as he talks to this group of Christians here about their walk with the Lord and what their aim is. Very famously, he says in chapter 3, verse 20, that our citizenship is in heaven. So Paul himself, just like maybe a lot of these Philippians, he was a Roman citizen. He had all the rights and privileges that go with that status. But more importantly, he was a citizen of heaven. And that didn't just mean I'm going to go to heaven someday after I die or when Jesus comes back. That also meant, so my life down here, my goal is to bring heaven down to earth, to bring the customs and the language and the way of thinking and living amongst the down here to the people that I'm with. And so let's keep plowing through this. In chapter 1, we're going to pick up the text here in verse 12, and we're going to read down through verse 18. I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel, so that it has become known throughout the whole imperial guard and to all the rest that my imprisonment is for Christ. And most of the brothers, having become confident in the Lord by my imprisonment, are much more bold to speak the word without fear. Some, indeed, preach Christ from envy and rivalry, but others from goodwill. The latter do it out of love, knowing that I am put here for the defense of the gospel. The former proclaim Christ out of selfish ambition, not sincerely, but thinking to afflict me in my imprisonment. What then? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed, and in that I rejoice. Yes, and I will rejoice. Awkward verse division, but we are going to leave it there and pick up in verse 19 next time. I want you to think about how strange Christians must have seemed. Christians who said things like the paragraph or two that we just read here in Philippians 1. You know, because if you were a Roman citizen and you were thrown in jail without a trial and you were kind of backed into a corner and you were forced to appeal to Caesar as Paul did in the book of Acts, we read that just a minute ago with Ty's reading, you might think that eventually that person would kind of start to pipe down about the beliefs that he was espousing, that he was teaching, that he was preaching, that caused him to wind up in a situation like that to begin with. But that's not what Paul did. You might expect that his opportunities would dry up as he gets to Rome and he starts talking to the Roman guards around him, and they start to realize, ooh, man, if I believe in what this guy believes in, that is probably going to happen to me too. No, thank you. I'm very happy with my life right now, out of chains and out of prison. But that's not what happened to Paul. You might expect that he would get discouraged, finding out that there are fellow Christians who are not imprisoned, who are out there preaching Christ for absolutely horrible, horrible motives in their hearts. Even though the doctrine that was coming out of their mouths seemed to be legit and seemed to be on track, they're doing that for terrible reasons. But he doesn't get discouraged.
at the end of what we just read, I mean, you know what it says. I'm just rejoicing that Jesus has preached. You might expect that this man's comrades who are around him in the church at Rome, that they would be discouraged as they look at him in prison and know that that could very well happen to them too. But that's not what happened in Paul's experience. So instead of the gospel flopping, when he gets to Rome, the gospel advances. And that is in this letter, which is partially a thank you note for the financial support that this church has given him, he wants them to know about the progress and not the regression of the gospel. So because Paul, in his mind, seems to be concentrating primarily on how Jesus being proclaimed is the main thing about his life, no matter whether he's in prison or not, we've got to be challenged in this text this morning about whether if we feel imprisoned in some ways in our lives, whether the advance of the gospel is primarily important to us too. So let's think about this. We're going to divide this up into two sections here. Paul's perspective on his personal situation and what he's doing. And then in 14 through 18, in the last part of this, his perspective on what other people are doing and how he's thinking about that. But I want you to notice 12 and 13 in a couple of different ways with me this morning. First of all, notice how he very emphatically wants to make known this point, that he is continuing to work. Even though this is not the way that he would like to work, these are unfavorable conditions for his work. You know, I think about it. If you've never read Philippians before and you knew Paul's situation, you might expect these verses to read differently. You might expect him to say, well, you know what, guys? I'd really like to tell you about studies going on and things happening in my work, but as you all know, I'm in prison. So there really hasn't been much to report. There's really not a whole lot going on with me because I'm sitting here in chains. And you might expect the Philippians to go, oh, well, yeah, I mean, that's understandable. It's unfortunate, but we get that, Paul. But that's not what he says. Instead, he says, I want you to know that I've had studies coming out my ears. I've had discussions with all kinds of people about Jesus. And notice how he says in verse 13, the ESV says, Imperial Guard knows about Jesus now. Some of your translations might say Palace Guard or even Praetorian Guard. This is a special squad of elite soldiers that actually served as the bodyguards of the emperor and fulfilled special missions there in the city of Rome and maybe some other places where they were stationed. They were also very, very powerful politically. In fact, we know outside of this, we know from history that just a few years before Paul was imprisoned, these Praetorian guards were actually responsible for assassinating one of the Caesars and putting another one into power. That's how influential these guys were. And so it's interesting that they are, at least some of them, are responsible for guarding this prisoner who's trying to appeal to the Caesar. And there were a lot of these guys. We know that there were about 12 cohorts of Praetorian soldiers with up to 1,000 men in each cohort. So you've got potentially here thousands of Roman soldiers who are exposed to the message of Jesus and the gospel is having its effect. Look over at the last part of the letter. I want you to just notice how he drops this in at the end here. So chapter 4, I'm looking in verse 22. This is almost the last verse. After he says, hey, greet everybody in Christ Jesus. Brothers who are with me, greet you. And then he says this. All the saints greet you, especially those of Caesar's household. You got people in the emperor's palace or that environment that are believers in Jesus now. So that's having its effect. And then you notice back in our text here in chapter 1, he's not just talking about the imperial guard. He's also, it says there in verse 13, all the rest. Well, who are the all the rest people? Well, I think that probably in Acts 28, remember how he's talking about how for 2 years, Luke says, everybody went to Paul and they heard the message and he was able to just teach all kinds of people. I think all the rest is all these people who are coming to his door. And so he's just got all kinds of opportunities, even though he himself is chained to one place. So his conditions were not ideal. How about you? How are your conditions right now in your life for spreading the message of the gospel in where you're at day to day, week to week, in your life right now? What I'm about to say, the applications that I'm about to make, I want to say a couple of things before I say those things. I understand that when it comes to doing kingdom work, you know, some of you might be thinking, oh man, like, I'm doing all kinds of kingdom work right now, and if I add anything more to my calendar, I'm going to keel over. Well, please don't keel over. Like, if that's you, don't keel over. But some of us, when it comes to thinking about kingdom work, might be on the other side of the spectrum and think, well, when I look at my calendar, there's not a whole lot going on as far as kingdom concerns. Maybe there's a lot of other things on my calendar. So I think regardless of who we are on the spectrum, you know, there's going to be a way to think about this that's going to be helpful for each of us. And so we need to just look, whatever your personal situation is, and we got a lot of different lives in here and a lot of different calendars, I'm just going to encourage all of us to just look inside of our own hearts and apply this however it applies. Okay, now having said all that, let me ask my question. Are you holding back from some kind of kingdom work right now because you're thinking about how right now in my life there are unfavorable conditions? And so I'm going to put off a lot of the things that I could think about to do because now is really not the right time. You know, if you are a young Christian in your teen years or your early 20s, maybe you might think, well, I just don't know as much as some of these other people do. You know, and I definitely don't have as much life experience as a lot of the other people in this room. And so I'm going to wait to really invest myself in Jesus' work until I get to be older. And then as you get to your mid-20s and your 30s, you know, your career is really starting to take off. And maybe you're getting married, maybe you're having some kids, and life is getting busier and busier. And so you think, well, surely I'm going to have more time when the next stage of life comes. And after I become an empty nester, and the kids grow up and the kids leave for college and do whatever they're going to do, then I'm going to have more time for the kingdom. But then you become an empty nester, and your career is still busy because now you have more experience and you have more responsibilities and you climbed the ladder. And so you think, well, okay, so in my 60s, maybe in my 70s even, then I'll have more time to devote to the Lord's work. When Tommy and Christy were here just a little while ago, and we had them over last Sunday afternoon, got some really good chats in with them. I asked both of them, so now that your three boys are gone, do you feel like you are less busy or more busy than you used to be? And Christy, just without missing a beat, said, oh, I am absolutely busier now than I've ever been in my life. So I mentally kind of checked that off as, okay, well, that's my trajectory too, I guess. And then, you know, we think about retirement. That's sort of the ideal that's held out that, man, that's really going to clear the schedule. But then you retire, and chances are you're probably going to have a lot more aches and pains and health problems to deal with. And so your calendar is then starting to fill up with doctor's appointments. And so at each stage of life. We can turn our gaze to the next stage, but we can see that there are still going to be things to consider, to worry about, to deal with in that stage too. So we can think about that individually, and we can also sometimes think about that congregationally in terms of a group here. Well, I mean, I can't really be productive here like I want to be until X, Y, and Z issues are taken care of here. You ever think that way? You know, then I'll really be able to ramp up. Then I'll be happy. A lot of other people will be happy. We'll be satisfied. Things will be going great. And I don't want to be Debbie Downer here. But I do want to make this point that even if those X, Y, and Z issues are taken care of overnight, we're still a group of saved sinners. We still all have our own baggage with us. We are still all fumbling our way towards each other imperfectly. We're still going to have things that we've got to figure out that are not the way that they should be. Now, is that to say, well, we just shouldn't work on anything? That's not what I'm saying. Whatever issue does come up, we should address that. We should work on things. We should grow. We should grow as a group. But what I'm saying is, don't think that, well, if we just take care of this, then everything, that's not the way congregations work. That's not the way individual lives work. So at every stage in your life or whatever group that you are a part of, you will probably have some reason to feel imprisoned. There will probably always be unfavorable conditions. And there's always going to be the temptation to put off colony work. And just think, well, I'll be better able to do that someday when things get easier. But that someday, if God grants you that time, that someday is also going to come with its own unique set of challenges. Remember what the Jews of Haggai's time kept saying? The time hasn't come to rebuild the house of the Lord yet. Because we tried that, and we got stymied by the leadership over us. And Haggai is sent by the Lord to say, no, the time is now. Time is now to go up there and finish the project you should have finished earlier. So I want to encourage myself and all of us here, don't wait to accelerate your spiritual life, your work with the Lord and with His people until you reach the ideal conditions, because they're not going to come. Don't wait until all of the stars are aligned, because they're never going to be until we reach heaven, of course. Don't plan to serve the Lord 10 years from now. Serve the Lord now with whatever you've got. And maybe you're just like the widow who's got the two mites to contribute to the Lord's work right now. Put your two mites in. He'll be happy with that. But put it in. Use whatever stage you're at to do whatever you can with the resources and time that you're given. Because that's what Paul did. And on a similar note, but at a slightly different point, I think we can extract this from the text too, that he kept working in his unfavorable conditions because he was able to tweak the way that he worked. You notice there's some adaptation in Paul's life and ministry right now. Because think about how Paul is not a stationary person by temperament, and by the way that he thought about his work. He was not Philip the Evangelist. Now, in Acts chapter 8, it's interesting, when we get done with Philip in Samaria and we get done with Philip with the eunuch, you notice the end of Acts 8 is Philip goes to Caesarea. And then by the time Acts picks up, Acts 21, Philip is still in Caesarea. I don't know if you ever noticed that before. And now he's got four unmarried daughters who prophesy. So apparently, he went to that spot, he parked himself there, and he never left, and he raised his family there, and he did God's work there. That is God's will for some of his workers, But for Paul, single guy that he was, unattached, he's able to just go all over the place. In Romans 15, Paul flat out says, my preaching goal is to not go somewhere where there's already a church and there's already people who know about Jesus. I want to go beyond. And he wrote the book of Romans from Corinth, and he's talking about visiting the Roman Christians in Rome. And he's also talking about, but eventually I want to go to Spain, and I want to preach in Tarshish, the westernmost part of the empire. So he's always daydreaming about how he can help other people at the next step, even as he does concentrate on what he can do right now with the people that he's with. But right at, in this letter, in his current situation, he is adapting. You know, what he does is he writes 4 of his 13 letters during this stage of his life. So this letter of Philippians, he also writes Ephesians. He also writes Colossians, and he also writes Philemon during this same time frame, because even though he couldn't travel around, he could send out his words and they could travel around. And even though he couldn't go to the marketplace, like we just read in Acts 28, he speaks to Jews and not Jews, non-Jews, all the time who come to his door. Again, he lived there 2 whole years at his own expense, welcomed all who came to him, proclaiming the kingdom of God and teaching about the Lord Jesus Christ with all boldness and, you notice how Luke says, without hindrance. Well, wait a minute. I thought he was in prison. I thought there was a lot of hindrance. No, the message can keep going out. The word of God is not bound, even though Paul's kind of hampered in some ways. Do you adapt the way that you work for Jesus when you run up against roadblocks and obstacles? I'll give a concrete example of somebody I think who did this well. I know a man who used to be a shepherd at a very large congregation in the southern part of our country. And his wife got sick with breast cancer, and they treated it, and she lived for a long time, but eventually she died. And so what happened at the same time was 2 big life events. He lost his spouse, and he stepped down as a shepherd from this congregation. And so he used to be married, and now he's not. He used to be an elder, and now he's not, but he's still got this skill set with him. So what does he do with it now? Well, he adapts. And so I spent a lot of time with him because he became a very active teacher in boys' camps. Camps that I would go to where the whole focus of the camp was to try to train up young Christian men to be leaders in their communities and in their churches. There's a lot of them, by the way. If you're ever interested in those, let me know. And so he taught at those, and then he also became a seminar teacher for congregations. And so now he travels all over the place teaching groups of God's people about shepherds and sheep and how to make that work. And he talks about marriage and family because he's got a lot of experience about that. He's still exercising his gifts of equipping the saints for the work of ministry, but he's just doing it in a different way than he used to do it. You ever run up against a shut door in what you do for Jesus? Do you look at that shut door and say, well, I guess that I don't need to work anymore? Or do you think, Lord, please show me a different way to go with the ministry that you've given me to work? I think all of us need to be thoughtful about that, because we're never done until we've drawn our last breath. And even then, I think there's an argument to be made that we're going to be doing some kind of work in the heavenly places when we're with God in eternity. We're never done being God's servants. So he adapted the way that he worked. And now in 14 through 18, he's got a really interesting way of thinking about the other Christians and the other people who are doing work. He talks about how he knows, because of his current life situation, the Christians around him there in Rome are emboldened. to serve more because they're able to see him, an example of faith, who is working through his hardship with wonderful attitudes. I think it's interesting what he says at the back half of verse 16. In the ESV, it says, knowing that I am put here. I'm put here for the defense and confirmation of the gospel. If you're using a New King James, Holman Christian Standard, something like that, it might say, I have been appointed. So in other words, the way that my life has turned out, it hasn't been an accident. It's not like, whoops, well, you know, God really dropped the ball on me there. You know, hello, I'm in prison, not supposed to be here. No, I was put here in order to fulfill this work. God wanted me to suffer like this so that I could confirm the truth of the message that I preach. And so even though his personal situation was difficult, the way that he handled it strengthened the hands and the hearts of the people who saw him go through this situation. You know, you would think that the persecution of a cause and a leader of the cause would make all the rest of the workers think, well, this is not good. We're going to lose heart because of this. But actually, it had the opposite effect because Paul was joyful. He was focused on Jesus as the one that he is working for and the gospel is spreading. He didn't wallow in despair. He does drop some hints here and there, scattered throughout these four letters about how hard this time was for him. But that's not at all at the forefront of these letters because he realizes that the eyes of so many are on him. And so he's framing this as an opportunity to help other people in their faith. And it's so neat that he's got that perspective. You know, I don't think that there are ever, ever easy, cut and dry answers for the question of why does God allow humans to suffer? Especially, why does he allow his children to suffer sometimes terrible things? No easy answers to that question, but I think one partial answer might be because he wants to use certain ones of his servants and hold them up as examples of faith for other people who need strength. Think about the example of Job. Why did Job suffer? Well, there's probably a lot of ways to answer that question. But I'm struck by something that James says in James chapter 5. You have heard of the steadfastness of Job. And that's all he says about Job's life. You know, and he's writing this letter to a whole bunch of people, and they would have said, yep, we all know the story of Job. Think about how many billions and billions of people by this point in history have heard of the story of Job. Countless lives. And James also says, you've heard of the steadfastness of Job, and you've seen how the Lord is merciful. People have seen Job and the way he handled that, and now billions of people have also seen the Lord that Job served and trusted and relied on, not to mention all the spiritual forces in the heavenly places who are watching it too. And so I want to ask myself and I want to ask all of us this question. When we're going through some sort of imprisonment and we're feeling confined, a genuinely discouraging, genuinely painful situation, are fellow believers encouraged or discouraged when they watch the way that we go through that situation, whatever it is? Do they just hear us complain? Do they just hear us cry out in pain and just say, this is not the way things should be? By the way, it's okay to say that sometimes, but are we also saying, blessed be the name of the Lord, like Job did? I really related to what Tommy said at the beginning of his Job sermon. I mean, if you remember, he got up and said, I really feel personally unqualified to teach about suffering because I've had a pretty easy life. I can say that too. I feel like, especially compared to some of your stories, I've had a pretty easy life. But thankfully, this morning, we're learning from someone who does understand about suffering. not just the Apostle Paul, but the Lord who put his words into Paul's mouth. So Christians were emboldened to serve when they saw his example and the way that he was working through that. And what really blows my mind about especially 15 through 18 is that we find that Paul could always find joy in the kingdom work that's going on, even though some of the people doing it were, quite frankly, terrible people, at least at this point in their hearts. So notice how he says, there are some who are out there preaching from love and goodwill, but there are some who are teaching the gospel because they've got envy, because they've got rivalry, because they've got selfish ambition in their hearts. And notice how he says, they actually are intending to cause me distress as they go out and do their work, and they're hoping that I'm going to hear about this, and I have been, and they want to discourage me. Now, you know, I think most of us think this way. If somebody accidentally says something that cuts you, but you understand that they're good people, they meant well in what they said, it's a lot easier to swallow that. It's a lot easier to say, you know, that comment stung, but we're going to let that go because I know that person is really sincere, trying to serve Jesus. But it's a lot harder to take it when someone is actually intending to hurt you in what they say, in what they do. And that is the situation here. Is they're sticking the knife in and they're twisting on purpose. And he feels that. And notice how I don't know why they're doing this. He doesn't explain the beef that they've got with him. And it doesn't really matter. What matters is how he answers his own question, verse 18. Notice how verse 18 starts with, what then? Well, what then indeed, Paul? I mean, should these people even be teaching the gospel to begin with? Should people be looking to them for wisdom and instruction in the ways of the Lord if they've got blackened hearts like they clearly do right now? They might be teaching the correct doctrines, but they are off inside of them. Should they be influencing these impressionable new converts who are coming in? What kind of effect do you think they're going to have on these people that they're teaching, Paul? There's some serious questions here. Is he putting his head in the sand like an ostrich and saying, well, we're just going to rejoice no matter what? No, he's not being an ostrich here. I think what he's saying is, even in the bad, God can cause good to blossom. And God is so smart and so wise and so powerful that he can even use rusty, broken tools to carve out his masterpieces. And I think what he's also saying here is, even if people don't like me, even if people don't have great attitudes about me and about my work, that is far less important than if they're working for Jesus in the kingdom. If they're teaching people, they're having Bible studies, they're helping people access the grace and the love of Jesus, even if they're not great toward me, you know, I can handle that because of what they're doing that's advancing the gospel. What humility that is. May God help all of us to imitate that kind of mindset. That is so challenging. But it goes to show that this is true of him. That the way that he looks at his life, the way that he looks at fellow Christians, is not through the primary lens of, are they treating me well? Do they have respect for me and for what I'm doing? Do they notice that I'm sitting in here in prison and I'm writing letters to people and congregations and I'm teaching the Praetorian Guard and I'm causing Caesar's household to obey the gospel? No, that's not how he's looking at things. He's looking at things as not just him, but all of God's people are components in this marvelous plan that is extending far beyond the little house where he was under house arrest. Is that how we think about our lives? This is how colonies grow. When God's people don't just internalize everything and make everything about them, like the Corinthian church was doing, of, I'm going to take you to court in front of the non-believers if you don't agree with me in whatever I want. God help us to not advance ourselves. God help us to advance the gospel and to be happy and content, even though we might be mistreated, to have Jesus being spread amongst those of us here and in the world. Do you have this kind of joy in your heart? Do I have this in mine? It's a challenging text, and I hope this gives you something to think about this week as you go through your life, your jobs and your home life and everything that you're doing in the kingdom for the sake of the gospel. If you need to let us know publicly as a group that you are struggling, that you need help with your soul, either to become part of this kingdom work for the first time, or you need to come back to it, and you need to wave the flag, and you need to say, I really need everybody to surround me and show me love and help and support. We can't know that you need help unless you let us know. And it doesn't have to be done in this kind of all-together format. It can be done privately with another Christian after the amen is said and we leave. But however it happens, it does need to happen. Do not suffer alone. Do not suffer quietly. If you are in prison and you're not doing well in your prison, part of the support network, part of the whole reason why a local church exists is so that we can help each other. Please let us do that if you need it. As together we stand and sing.